amendments to PD number 4, Concord Crimes, PD number 1.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and
get her, if we can, people who are here can agree on it. It kind of boils down to you, Judge.
The voting numbers. Well, you finally got it. You finally got us, Judge.
What's so different? This happens every day. Well, why don't you start?
Now, do you want to go back over the minutes at all of our last subcommittee meeting? They're really not germane to this, except,
Well,
it's a meeting before.
It's a meeting of April 4, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why don't you just...
Section 7 reflects the directions to me, as I construed them, of course, in that meeting. And I have eliminated any reference to the Fifth Amendment problems. Remember, we had a provision in there that said you can't ask questions if it's going to involve the Fifth Amendment right or worse of that effect. And we also had a provision on the State versus Phillips, which said the state has a right to examine and so forth. We took both of those out so that the section now makes no reference to either situation, with the effect that whatever the Fifth Amendment law is after Shepard versus Cole is still in effect, and whatever the State versus Phillips is still in effect. My case, my decision alone. So that takes care of the problem here.
Do we have in this book the text of the of the amendments?
Yeah. No, you mean the text of the Second Amendments, or you mean
the way it was before or after?
After our last meeting.
Well, this is the one after our last meeting.
No.
This is the Second
Amendment. Yeah, the Second Amendments to preliminary draft number 4. And they should be in your book there also.
That's what it says.
Second Amendment. Oh, yeah, here we are.
So this section is considerably shorter than it was. And I think I made an adjustment in language in the definitive objection to psychiatrists and children in the state. The court didn't call it showing the direct state to select a different psychiatrist, which was generally agreed on as language. So as I said before, we've really finished the question. Without hurt, we haven't changed the law at all.
Well, and as I recall, it was the...
Have you expanded the law? That was the fear.
I can't even make up your form.
Good. I think what we ought to do, and there's no objection to the contrary, we should pass along Section 7 as presently amended to the full commission with the recommendation that the full commission consider it, and many of the members of the subcommittee couldn't have been here today to make objections at that time. I'm sure the minutes show that my colleague here would show that we're not trying to avoid Shepard versus Ball. We recognize we couldn't anyway, short of the constitutional change. And the only thing I would add is simply what I said informally a little earlier, that I recently had an instance in which I appointed a psychiatrist, or rather I issued an order containing Shepard versus Bull restrictions on a psychiatrist which the state asked to examine the defendant on its behalf. Dr. Ivor Campbell of Portland, and he conducted the examination without any apparent difficulty, and later testified both as to his examination and supplemented that by observation in court without any apparent trouble. So at least that one instance where it didn't make much difference. What is the next section?
Before we go on, let me ask a question generally. This section is a good example of concern I have with respect to the relation of my original notes and comments and the notes and comments that we will now send back to the commission. Obviously, this section considerably changed, and this will make a necessity of changing the commentary. But I look at it as possibly a two-level problem. It seems to me that it might be useful to the full commission to have almost the full commentary again with the explanation that we discussed at length, Shepherd versus Bowe, and leave it in the commentary discussion. We discussed State versus Bowe, and we decided in the committee to eliminate the language. The point I'm trying to make is that the commission then will have a full commentary to explain. Well, otherwise, it wouldn't appear here at all, Marty. You know, simply say what this does and what it's based on without exposing the real problems, the iceberg that we cruised around. Now, I don't know whether it would be appropriate after the commission, assuming they adopt this version, that I don't know whether it's appropriate to put that kind of argumentative commentary into the final draft of the commentary. Because it does, in a sense, it is argumentative. It does pose policy choices, and since the commission then, assuming they get a full comment and they adopt this section, then perhaps we ought to distill the thing out. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it would be in order to have it before the commission, I mean, to consider it. I'm not so sure that we ought to have it afterwards.
It might make more losses than concerns me. I did the same thing with respect to burden of proof. I repeated my original comments on burden of proof, where I took a different view. I should point out to the commission that this was my view only, and that the committee had voted against it, but I think it would be appropriate to probably take that out entirely, and when such time that the commission agrees with the subcommittee's provision, then the defendant should have the burden.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that.
But I left it in on purpose.
Well, I think the commission ought to know what the arguments and counter-arguments were, and have it in the commentary that goes to that.
The thing that makes me hesitate is it really amounted to about a personal view. No one in the committee agreed with me, and I don't think anybody agreed with me about Shepherd versus Bowe and the view that I took. This is why I'm raising the point. Well, should the reporter, in a sense, voice his opinions off in these commentaries when in fact the subcommittee hasn't really agreed with me? I'm not proud of it at all. I'm very happy to take it out, but if you think there's some purpose left in it, leave it in. Otherwise, I'll take it out.
Of course, we discussed Shepherd versus Bowe at the commission meeting in January.
True.
But it's been a few months since that meeting, and they're going to be pretty cold on a lot of this.
I think it'd be more helpful to the commission members to have it in there.
Well, I'll certainly make clear that this is the view of the reporter and was not occurred in by the subcommittee. So, full disclosure on that.
Okay.
Section 10. Section 10, every time I reread this section, it causes me difficulty because I find some way to restate it, or I find some way in which it doesn't say what it ought to say. I think each time we go over it, it gets better as far as the language goes, but I'm a little worried about it because this morning I went over it again and I've got four or five interlinings of soft spots that I found, or places where I thought it could be improved, aside from policy questions. So I suppose if this is going to be one of those kind of sections, it's going to be in a state of transitional language change right up to the last section, because it's so complicated. There's so much here.
Yeah. Well, it's a complicated procedure. You're spelling out in a little bit.
Actually, the directions that I had from the commission to the subcommittee last time were language change corrections.
That was my recollection.
To clarify and to eliminate some conflicting provisions or some inappropriate references, for instance, to probate officer and a couple of things like that. And I think I got those. But in doing that, for instance, on page one there, subsection one, the last sentence is very awkward. It says the burden of proof by preponderance. And it winds up, I said the burden of proof by preponderance, and then I say shall be borne by the state down at the end. But the sentence would read much better, I think, if we start out by saying the state shall bear the burden by preponderance. It's leaving the shall be borne by the state off entirely. These are some of the things that I see as I go back over. And it doesn't. I don't think it changes the meaning of the sentence. It just simply makes the sentence a little less unwieldy. Just to make sure that sentence can be improved still.
Well, you still
can't read this section.
No,
this is responsive now to, I believe, the point you raised, is the allocation of burden of proof in a couple of instances where the draft had been silent, and ambiguous certainly, because of the silence. And I hope, but I'm not absolutely sure that I've eliminated that ambiguity in this provision. Certainly the intent is that when the issue of the original hearing is whether to discharge the person, when the court may discharge, finding that he's maybe mentally affected, but he's no longer dangerous, in which case he discharge, or find that he's not mentally affected at all and discharge. That if in fact the state seeks commitment or release on supervision, then it bears the burden on those two issues. Does this, in your opinion,
solve
the problem?
Yeah. Really, the state isn't seeking commitment in the sense that, as I understand it, the minute you have a not guilty by a reason of insanity finding or verdict, or you have the hearing automatically, or you have the determination whether you have a separate hearing or not. And by the way, I might just mention there, since we've been in this area on two or three cases I've had, including one yesterday that I talked about earlier, each time I have made a record of whether or not the defendant wishes to have a separate hearing, he wishes to have evidence separately, which he doesn't want to have, and whether or not he agrees to have the evidence that came in on the merits be considered on the subsequent question. And without exception, whether this is simply due to the fact that the lawyer doesn't want to go through a useless procedure or whatever, but my impression would be that they wouldn't, except in a very rare instance, wouldn't want a separate hearing. Just say, well, you heard the evidence, go ahead and decide it. But I agree with you. I think the state ought to have the burden at that junction. I don't think the burden ought to be on the defendant. Maybe I'm wrong there. I don't know.
This is for commitment purposes. This
is on the original hearing, the original judge, determination.
The judge has three options. He can discharge entirely, the standard set up here, or he may release on supervision, or he may commit to the Illinois State Hospital. The first one, subparagraph 1, deals with a situation where the court may discharge entirely. Subsection 2 deals with the situation and what the court does must find when it wants this release on supervision. And subparagraph 3 relates to the commitment.
On that commitment thing, don't you want to make that commitment to the mental health division of the Board's Superintendent of Oregon State Hospital, just from the point of view of long range?
We talked about that.
You may be right.
We talked about that, as I recall, and I think, as I recall, what we said was that at the present time we would leave the language the way it is. I believe this is what we said. Not that we're happy with it, but that we wait until we get farther along to.
As I recall, the existing language now in the statutes, where there's a reference to commitment, it is to the Oregon State Hospital.
Yeah,
and that may be in
To the institution.
This time?
No, I said they're trying to.
Yeah.
They want us to, instead of having the judge commit to, remember last session, to the PAN or the correctional institution, you commit to the corrections division. They make the decision. The other question I have is, when you refer to a state institution, are you thinking of a state hospital?
Section 10? Yeah.
No, section 7.
Oh. Let's see what I said there.
What we had in mind there was to provide flexibility so that the court could send him to the state hospital or to Damish, or you could send him to a suitable private or public facility in the county.
You could also send him to a penitentiary or a correctional institution, refer to a state institution.
That's why I was wondering if that's what you had in mind.
Well, the desirability was flexibility, in the sense that, that normally, what has been the habit in the past is if you send them anywhere, you send them to Oregon State Hospital, mm-hmm. Ward 38 or whatever it is. There's in some cases there's objection to that from the expense factor, mm-hmm. perhaps from some others, and that if there's a suitable facility nearby.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't that. It was just that he said state institution as opposed to for the mentally ill or whatever.
Be, it could be in the penitentiary if for some strange reason there's a psychiatric facility there.
Well,
there would be
they're diagnostic.
Well, I'm assuming
it
would
be certainly would be within the broad intent of send them any place and it happens to be convenient.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay.
Well, I think that I certainly think that, that we could make the wording on the second paragraph, second one, better.
About the burden of proof.
Mm-hmm.
We can make it active rather than passive.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing that kind of bothers me about this burden of proof on the state now. Here you've got a trial in which the insanity defense has been raised by the defendant. You go through a trial and you've got the state resisting this, in fact, trying to disprove this defense. The state, through the course of the trial, is saying the defendant's sane. So now he's acquitted. And suddenly the state has to shift gears and take the other side of the coin if they want him committed, and then they have to come forward and, with the burden of proving that he is suffering from a mental defect that should be committed. Isn't
well, I don't think that's inconsistent. What the state is doing at the trial is they're saying he knew the difference between right and wrong 6 months ago, and then assuming the jury finds that he didn't, the question shifts, is he now dangerous to himself or others? And I don't think the state has to shift gears that badly in order to prove that issue.
You're going to tell me, if you try any of these cases on it before a jury, you're going to tell the jury that there's going to be a hearing on this subject if they acquit for a reason?
No, that's one of the issues.
No, this is one of the areas we haven't really learned.
It's a matter that came up in the jury project study. Because
yeah,
one of the cases was insanity, and the jurors spent a great deal of time discussing the issue of it. Well, I wouldn't mind going to that point. I darn well that this guy would be put away someplace because he needs to be put away. You know, that kind of speculation that would
I'm aware of that study,
and
I did quite a bit of research, which doesn't appear in any of these things because we don't have any provision on it. I came to the conclusion that there ought to be in the instruction the information to the jurors that what is likely to happen or what will happen if they bring in an insanity verdict. Now there's a case in Oregon that says that that's inappropriate.
Yeah.
It's a decision of law that they may not be instructed that way, but I don't think it's not constitutional. There was a discussion in the case of a constitutional issue with respect to that instruction, but I don't think it came down on that issue, and that I think that by statute it could be reversed. Desirable, but I don't think it's going to make too much difference because the reports I read of your project show that it didn't make any difference to the jurors. They all knew it anyhow. That they assumed that there would be, they knew what would happen if they brought in an insanity verdict.
I would say that as the one who took those cases to court and bugged the juries, that isn't my understanding of what the jurors.
I read
the book.
Yeah, well, the book says that they concludes that it didn't make any difference. Whether they were or were not instructed, the insanity, the incident of NGIs wasn't different. Didn't affect them.
Well,
but I don't think they really tested
we
that
didn't
issue.
Test that. It was not one of the.
They didn't test the issue of whether or not. It would make a difference if you were told, find him not guilty and he'll be committed.
That's it. That wasn't the variable, to put that in or take it out of the case. It was one of the things I thought would have been interesting if they put it into the variable, but then I just had to go to court that many more times. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish I had anything with me. It's been some time since I looked at that, too. But I was under the impression.
Where they didn't get any difference between the NGI verdicts and the other was depending on the instruction.
Well, I don't know. Do you?
Well, I agree with you there too. But I'm certainly under the other impression with the report from the book. Now, this may be entirely wrong. I may be wrong about my impressions, or the book may have reported your findings incorrectly. This is Simon's book.
Yeah. Or I was under the impression that I may disagree on what the jury was saying. What they were saying.
You may be entirely right. I'll go back and refresh myself on that. It'd be interesting.
Well, one of the impressions I had is that one of the things that would have done is shorten the length of the jury deliberations considerably. If they had had that solved, that problem resolved for them, so they didn't sit and speculate.
Compromised jury verdicts is a big problem, too.
Big virtue.
Yeah.
I don't know. The question is, should we have the burden of proof?
Well, that's a policy question.
Maybe we don't. Maybe at the outset we don't need to have a burden.
Well, we didn't in the draft as I originally stated. Yeah. In this particular case, I was.
You know, as I recall, I raised the question,
raised,
didn't
yeah,
I?
That's right. You raised the question.
As to where should the burden be, and so on.
Assertiveness, or trying to assert.
Now on page 12, near the bottom of the page, about three quarters of the way down.
Can be said,
where it starts out, Chairman Burns had two or three suggestions to make on the draft. Mm-hmm. He noted the present statute, no burden was spoken of, which was somewhat concerning. Since allocation of burden is mentioned in sub 2 and 3, and we'll consider this in regard to sub 1. Professor Platt thought Chairman Burns was right at this point in suggesting it was his suggestion that the state have the burden of commitment, the defendant had the burden of proving that he should not be committed.
That presumably must mean that the defendant not have the burden of proving he should not be committed.
I don't think that's contradictory.
Yeah, it is. It's
got to be one way or the other.
Yeah, right. That's it.
If you look at it in another light, Don, if you think the state has to shift gears.
In fact, Maxine asked me about that when we were doing the minutes. That's why. It read okay when I.
In somewhat the same situation as the state. The defendant has had the burden proved by preponderance of the evidence under our determination of this policy, proved his insanity. And now he has to shift gears and prove, well, he's not that insane or not that dangerous. So he has to shift gears in the same sense, I guess, the state has to shift gears. So it kind of cancels itself out, which is
Of course, maybe the original problem isn't that great. Actually, right now, there isn't anything said about the burden. I mean, they place the burden on the defendant under Newton versus Brooks when he tries to get out. But as of today, the initial determination is just if the court finds it dangerous and so forth, why, away you go. Maybe it's better just to shake up all the lawyers by saying on this issue neither side has the burden of proof. That'd really shake them up.
or as the minutes have it, that'd shake them up. The state shall prove that he should be committed, and the defendant shall prove he shouldn't.
They shouldn't. Yeah,
everybody has the burden of
not have the proof.
Yeah, it's just as bad for everybody to have it as nobody to have it. Well, I don't know, by golly. Maybe it's better, maybe it'd be better to why don't we do this? Why don't we just send it along as is and raise the question with the commission and let them make a decision?
You can always reestablish the language as I had it when I was in trouble.
You'd probably just tell the state go ahead and say anyway, wouldn't you? I mean, if it didn't say anything, I mean, when it came time for this hearing, you'd expect the state to at least come forward with it.
Oh, I tell you, whoever's there gets called. Really, is what it amounts to. You don't. It's like a search and seizure case. You always have the state's witnesses first, even though if there's a warrant, why the burden is on the defendant. But just call the witnesses anyway. You know, nobody gets excited about that. Well, let's just refer that. You had, I think you said you had some other...
Well, I noticed here on page 3 of the draft, section 3rd line, the 3rd line starts, court determines that the person continues to be... I really wanted to include the phrase, affected by mental disease or defect and years of substantial mental disease.
Continues to be
affected by mental disease or defect and is a substantial danger, because otherwise I'm afraid there would be an implication that although he may be no longer affected by mental disease or defect, but is a substantial danger to himself, that he may be retained. That's not the purpose here, so I wanted to put that phrase in there. I simply dropped it out somewhere. That's why this has been somewhat difficult and cumbersome to draft, because that phrase has to be repeated. In conjunction with the substantial danger phrase, or it's liable to have a substantial effect on what a court may find.
You've got a couple of other drafting problems there. It seems to me your burden of proof phrase, if you read it the way it appears in the text, is lost in a section that really tells you about what a court can make an order to. You're saying, after entry of a judgment of not guilty, the court shall, on the basis of evidence, make an order as follows. One or two is what it amounts to. And in one, you've got the burden of proof buried in it, and in two, you've got conditions of release buried in it. And I'm kind of wondering if those...
Well, it's
not making it hard for somebody to find it, you know...
I think you're right, and this has been the result of redrafting in the light of trying to allocate that burden up in subparagraph 1. I don't think that problem existed in the draft that I had before, which is not to say that it couldn't be drafted around.
Why can't it be a separate section? Proceedings under section 10 of this act, the state shall have the burden of proving by preponderance of the evidence that so-and-so.
Well, there are so many different allocations, though, that it becomes complicated, because in some places the defendant has it. In two or three instances, the defendant has it, depending on what the hospital recommends.
Why don't we do this? If we decide to take that last sentence out, then that'll solve
I think so.
Drafting problem.
I think so. But as I say, look at this, I find it makes me uncomfortable, the whole section.
Is it bad drafting to say that when you first use the phrase affected by mental disease or defect, substantial danger, and thereby a substantial danger, hereafter?
Well, I thought about that too, but I don't think it would gain much, because they become separated later.
Yeah.
You have to state them in the alternative later, and it would kind of dilute any kind of a definition.
So why do you use the A's and B's under 2 instead of numbering the subsection? Yeah, drafting generally, you know, the A's and B's, it comes because it's subsumed under the alternatives or something or other.
Not the good reason, but the real reason is that this is based on a California draft reason. That this probably reflects the structure of that draft still.
One is springing him, two is supervising him, and three is commitment. This is what it boils down to.
I think if we can get the policy of this thing straightened out, that I'd like to have a thorough run and perhaps restructuring the whole section. But as we've gone along here, we've had so many policy problems that
Well, that's right.
We find a policy change from one meeting to the next, and it does affect the entire structure of the section. Perhaps if we can today decide which way we want to play the burden, and if in fact everything else is all right, it's a matter of policy, we ought to take a good hard run and draft the whole section.
Well, basically, on, under your section two, if there's a rehearing, the burden of committing the man to the hospital after he's once been released would be on the state. Mm-hmm. And the and the burden is on the defendant if he wants to get off earlier than 5 years.
Right.
And then under sub three, the burden shifts back and forth depending on whether the hospital favors or opposes release.
Right.
Whenever he's been committed.
Right. If the hospital favors release, then the burden goes to the state to counter that. Where the hospital favors commitment, continued commitment, and the defendant is proven he should be let out.
Did you have some other dramatic changes?
Yeah, let's see. I want to add a, I think the sentence or paragraph, I'm not sure which one, on page 7, just before the beginning of the last paragraph. The last paragraph begins any person. But prior to that, I would insert language in this effect. This person is on release. I did not cover that, I don't think, at this point. We cover the situation where he's in the hospital. But I haven't covered the situation where he's on release at the 5 year period. So to cover that, I want to say if the person is on release, release on supervision at the end of the 5 year period, and the state wishes to have this release on supervision continue, the state must prove by preponderance of the evidence that the person on release continues to be affected by a mental disease or defect and continues to be dangerous to himself and or the person of others, but can be controlled. This is a phrase, the phrase. So that, I think there was a hiatus in that particular provision, that particular aspect.
First, we say up above, the court may release him on supervision.
Yeah.
But not for more than 5 years from the original entry of the order of release on supervision.
Are you referring now to sub 2?
2A,
yeah.
On page 3.
Supervision may be kept under that status for 5 years.
Well, I would suggest it should go in at the, it should go in on page 4, just above paragraph number 3, which is the last part of the section dealing with supervision. But I'm not sure that the subcommittee, as a matter of policy, would buy that. In other words, if the guy isn't hadn't harmed anybody for 5 years, why let's turn him loose, so to speak.
All right. Is it a policy determination? Right.
Why don't you redraft it and put it in on page 4, at the just above Arabic 3, and make a note of it, and then we'll take it up, and then make a decision on it.
The silence in the draft reflects the silence in the California draft, and that may be the very reason. Although there's no explanation of why that is. silence there in the commentary. Maybe the very reason that they decided that, well, if he's harmless enough to be on release for 5 years, there's no point in continuing it beyond that. Therefore, we're making a provision about it.
Because without that language, at the end of 5 years, it would just automatically expire. Yeah.
I think that's all
okay.
Major nature. That is not to say that the language may not be changed as far as structure goes.
Well, but
when I get around, yeah. When I get through the policy cutting.
I'm going to get the full commission inside the policy. And I know we're going to have a dog and cat fight on this section anyway. The minute the boys at the state hospital see this one, they're going to holler their heads off, I think.
Well, they've seen it, at least we certainly haven't tried to hide it from them. We've sent them copies of this material.
They maybe aren't paying attention to it.
Why do you think? Because it puts them in a position of having to take care of these people?
Well,
they can't swing them out the door.
Respect for release.
They've got to keep them all at least 90 days when they're sent down. And it's our experience from some of the testimony and practical applications that sometimes they won't keep them overnight. They'll let them go right away. It's certainly a lot shorter period than 90 days. Plus the fact that now the hospital has given some duties to keep track of how long these people have been committed and to inform the court 30 days ahead of time that they've been here for 5 years. And that's a duty, it's an administrative burden. There, it's going to cost some money somewhere that they may not be interested in. Beside a couple of the policies about respect to release, they're taking this draft takes away from the state hospital the authority to release. The court is going to be invested in that authority with this draft. I don't think they're going to complain about that. Well, maybe they will, because it stops them from putting these people back out sooner.
Well, you'll hear the old one, too, that it's a medical decision.
Well, the psychiatrists that we've had testify do not agree with that. They agree with the policy that we draft, not from the hospital, but
they
were unanimous in agreeing that this should be a legal decision by the court, not a medical decision by the hospital. We were surprised by that, mm-hmm. as I recall. Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, section 12.
But this is now that the first version is as it was, and the second version changes the. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. The first version is changed, and it eliminates the Fifth Amendment reference, the language that he may not be asked any questions, the answers to which may be self-incriminating. That's been eliminated in parallel with section 7. In addition, section 12 has been drafted in the alternative to remove the mandatory provision that the court must appoint a psychiatrist to examine on the incompetency issue. And it allows the court, in its discretion, if it wants to have a psychiatrist, otherwise to decide the issue itself without dragging the psychiatrist in at all. I've drafted that in the alternative to show that the court may call to its assistance in reaching the decision any witness mm-hmm. and may appoint a psychiatrist. Now, maybe I didn't even have to say that because a psychiatrist would be a witness, I suppose, but I thought it maybe better be made explicit.
Yeah.
The rest of the section repeats much of what now exists, assuming that a psychiatrist is called and he got to provide for getting paid and his report and things of that sort. So that isn't changed as a matter of policy and language.
Why do you have the paragraph in the alternate form, George, about the psychiatrist may employ a new method, which is accepted by the medical profession?
In the alternative?
In the alternate form, section 12. Following paragraph 2,
you know,
an unnumbered paragraph.
We talked about that, I can't remember now what we...
Page 2.
Yeah.
Well, there was similar language in the other section here.
It should be in the first one, too.
Yeah. Oh, well, I just noticed it in the second one.
Yeah, it's left out of the first one by mistake.
What's the rest?
Wasn't we talking about hypnosis and that kind of stuff?
It's in there, sub 2, in section 12.
Oh yeah, sub 2 in section 12 is drafted.
Well, I just noticed it in the second one, but I was kind of wondering why it's there.
mean, why it's there? Well, we haven't talked about that since months, but as I recall... This has not been an issue lately. But
that wasn't discussed
earlier. The explanation is that most statutes in the country, in fact, I think almost universally, make no reference whatsoever to the standards for the examination. And this is a, perhaps, I don't know whether it's really effective, but it is at least a general reference to some standard by referring to what would be accepted in the medical profession. In conducting one of these examinations.
I kind of wonder if this isn't like the pharmacy one that says it has a section in it, you know, you shall not sell poisons, but nothing in this section prevents you from selling ice cream. Why would you expect a psychiatrist to employ a method that isn't acceptable by the medical profession when he's a member of the profession?
Well, not.
And subject to discipline by the profession for misconduct.
Hesitate to make this statement because I don't think it's true at all, but a psychiatrist is not necessarily a medical doctor. That exists some places.
I don't think that's true in Oregon.
No, I don't think it's true here. I can't remember, frankly, because it's been so long since we've gone through that particular... The original formula, I think, does. Let me see if I can find it.
Well, that's our
outlook
for it.
Yeah, in the original responsibility draft,
it's the kind of thing that,
which I didn't bring with me either.
Kind of,
well,
it should be there in the book.
It says here, subsection 2 clarifies the question of what methods may be used in the examination, a point on which statutes in Oregon and most jurisdictions are silent.
Well, I'm not sure that it does. On the other hand, I'm not sure you want to draw a reaction from the point of view of the... a psychiatrist employing a method accepted by the medical profession or acceptable by psychiatrists of comparable standards. After all, he is a specialist.
This was discussed at one of the earlier meetings with psychiatrists, and they did not object to the language. As I recall, they approved this particular reference.
Well,
what bothers me now is that I'm not sure it says anything.
Well, that does, and then on the other
But it was not, the psychiatrist did not disagree with it because of the reference to the medical profession.
Okay.
That wasn't one of their concerns. And they seemed to think this was all right. And
well, somebody
if
came
anything,
in,
it's innocuous.
Well, that, and then we run into this other problem that I'm thinking of. In one of the drug bills that came in this time, a doctor suggested language like this. Something should be put in treating drug addicts. You shouldn't do anything that isn't accepted by the medical profession. And somebody gave them to me and said, you're incorporating these in the bill, so I incorporated them. And when it turned out that somebody wanted to pin him down to find out what it was he specifically had in mind when he said this, you know, because they were thinking, like, far out techniques. He was thinking of things like methadone block pain treatment. He didn't believe in them. He wanted to section it to prevent anybody from using that as a technique of treatment. Well, you see there, you've got a difference of opinion within the profession as to what is or is not a treatment technique. And when that became apparent, I think the sentence came back out again, simply because it was a feeling that you might be placing a limitation on treatment or examination, in this case treatment methods, because of differences of opinion.
I have no objection if you want to eliminate the language, but I really... farther away from it now than I'd like to be, but I think that Kathleen is entirely correct. I don't think it's kind of innocuous, and perhaps it might even harm.
Well,
I don't see that the section's operation would be harmed because subsection 3 is a pretty clear indication of the kind of things we want in it. And that had not heretofore been the case at all, no direction at all in the legislation for what should generally be.
Well, I think your A description of the nature of the examination is going to be one of the helpful things to the judge if he comes in with, the psychiatrist comes in with some weirdo.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you,
sub 3 has had some considerable thought and some changes in language and some redrafting, so I wouldn't want to tinker with that one, but sub 2 could come out of there, I guess, really. Unless on restudying this thing, I find a better reason than I've been able to remember.
Why don't you leave it in and keep track of it, and mean, I'm reluctant to take it out because there's nobody here other than myself who would actually remember the subcommittee. I wouldn't want to do that, but I'm sure...
I think the model penal code section, I'm not sure, but I think it contains language to this effect. And if it does, there might be something helpful in the explanation there that I can check back into, see why they got it. I'll check that at any rate, and it may be a fruitful source.
Look at section
providing 4.05
the model penal code.
4.05? I don't have the comments for it.
Yeah, yeah. 4.05 sub 2 of the model penal code states, in such examination, any method may be employed which is accepted by the medical profession for examination of those alleged to be suffering from mental disease or defect.
So it remains then for me to go back and refresh myself on why the model penal code thought that was such a hot idea. And we may have a reason that now is debating here.
Well, this experience that I just had so recently with it
Certainly you want to stir up that kind of problem, so maybe a good place to do a little maxing. Now, this wasn't responsive to a particular medical man or a particular psychiatrist's request. This was based on the
Maybe the similarity.
Which might have been based on the request from a particular doctor. So you've got the choice here, and then if you decide from that,
basically either one is silent on Shepherd versus Bowen.
That's right. That's right.
It doesn't take
intention
away or doesn't add.
Right. It's my contention that Shepherd versus Bowen applies here, and it's your contention that it doesn't. So we have a difference of opinion, which makes life interesting.
Awesome.
Does not add to the difficulty of this section when we remain silent, at least on the issue.
Yeah. Okay, well, that takes care of responsibility. He said responsibility.
Well, what do you want to do, Judge? You want to leave this in the alternative, or you want to adopt the section?
I think we ought to leave it in the alternative because we don't have the full subcommittee were here, three of us were here. I'd say we ought to make a decision and send it to commission this way.
I'm not here to write an explanation for the commentary because I haven't got one. The commentary does not exist. I still think that's a good idea. I'd like to see the commission adopt that discretion to eliminate bringing psychiatrists in where possible.
Mm-hmm.
Save some money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, of course, the minutes of April 4 indicates that at least one other member of the subcommittee was in favor of this, Mr. Clark.
Well, you know, since then, I don't think we've ever really gone back and faced the issue that we kind of skirted. And I think there's kind of been a vacillation. And that is, do we want to prohibit, as we do here, I forget what section it's in, we prohibit in this response, in this incompetency proceeding. I think I can find this. Yeah, we say the report shall not contain any findings or conclusions as to whether the defendant, as a result of mental disease or defect, was responsible for the criminal act charge. And we've kind of had some arguments and some misgivings about that. Because this means that this reverses the universal practice of responding on both issues, although the issue for which the psychiatrist has been called in is strictly for the incompetency.
Although Judge Bryson has recently been changed policy in that regard, partly in response to Shepherd versus Bowen. Some of his orders now read report only on competency, not on responsibility.
Well, the point was made, it was well taken last time, as a practical, I forget who it was, raised it as a practical matter. This is going to double the cost of examination in a lot of cases. But I still feel that the Shepherd versus Bowe situation is so serious that where we can avoid the incriminating determination issue that we ought to try, that we ought to avoid it. And this is one way to avoid it, at least with respect to the mixing of the kind of responses that the...
Of course, under this wording, could not the defendant waive the protection of that? That's maybe what we might do, is say, shall not contain unless the defendant consents to have it so contained, or something like that. That would get around the thing. In other words, if the defendant wants...
And well, that's why the defendant in the first place asked for an incompetency proceeding, isn't it, really? He wants to know about his client's mental responsibility. He
sure,
knows that the answer will be, as well as incompetency, will tell him what he needs to know for cheap about his client's mental responsibility.
And how, what his tactics are going to be from there on. And at least my impression is that the appointed attorneys, in, by and large, in Multnomah County, are perfectly happy to get the answer to both questions on a one-shot deal.
Mm-hmm. Some of them probably would not be happy where the state has made the request for the incompetency, mm-hmm. which occurs less as near as...
Yeah, I would say that certainly a greater percentage of the request is initiated by the defendant than by the...
Well, suppose we put a as you suggested here, this do any damage? I don't think it would hurt anything to say, which shall not contain unless the defendant raises no objection to the report of both issues. I don't see that kind of...
Unless the defendant consents to have...
Yeah, the defendant ought to do something positively, shouldn't
he? Unless the defendant consents to have the report contain such an opinion. Whatever you want to say.
Now, this bothers me too, because something that we kind of sweep under the rug, and I don't know what the answer is, how's the defendant going to be able to waive anything if in fact he isn't competent? Or if in fact he's insane? And we're assuming that he's got some capacity to agree or consent all along, you know, and also after the trial is over, and you ask the defendant's counsel if he wants to present evidence, and he says, we waive. Well, how in the world does he have capacity to waive if he, in fact, is crazy? I don't know what the answer to that is. I guess we just sort of forget that one.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the same problem here.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the other way, you might get at it if you take Judge Bryce's approach and say, unless specifically directed to do so by the court, the psychiatrist shall include no such material. When somebody, for special circumstances, takes an affirmative action to have this material included.
Well, the court may take action in contradiction of what the defendant's desires might
yeah.
be, though. I think it's the defendant that ought to be considered here, primarily, because of his self-incrimination problem.
Well, and then you can bind them even at that, then, and say that the defendant requests and the court specifically directs. So if you had a defendant who was in a bad state, you decided what he was doing, but he was so far out, he, you know, had no meaning or was not communicating, the court might still say, well, in this case, I think you'd be better off not to have it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Judge? How does that suit you as a judge?
Well, I don't know. That,
that at least allows the defendant to trigger it. Gives him the primary...
Well, it gives him the power to stop it.
Yeah, to stop it. Right?
Yeah.
But it also prevents him from obtaining it if, in fact, the judge, especially under our alternative, looks at that fellow sitting there and says, you're just not competent. And I can see that as a without the aid of a psychiatrist, see that you're not competent to do anything. Gosh, sir.
Of course, that'd be a pretty rare instance in which, if the guy was that far out, you're going to pack him off and forget him anyway as a practical matter.
Well, Kathleen's suggestion is good from the standpoint of the day-to-day practice of an attorney that's in court representing this guy on a plan or something. It would still give him the availability of this double-barrel examination.
Why don't you do it that way? Why don't you do it that way? Unless specifically
that's what directed by the court.
Unless the defendant consents.
They want to find out if they've got an incentive to defend.
Unless the defendant requests. We want to put it positively still, don't we, on the part of the defendant, so that he doesn't lose this by default as a copy?
Well, yeah. In other words, he doesn't put it in unless two things happen. The court directs him to, and the defendant consents that he do it.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you're going to word that.
You could even make it stronger than consent and make it request. You could make it that the defendant requests this and the court directs it.
Well, okay. That's okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That would seem to afford the protection.
Well, you could say, except for the court and the defendant both request to the contrary, the report shall not, and so forth.
Well, I think I can have just
okay.
I'll work it out. Okay.
You know the old saying, I care not who writes the nation's laws, and I can as long as I can write the nation's songs.
Who's that, George M. Cohan?
I don't know. Well, okay, and now we're through with responsibility. Which brings us to inchoate crimes. And here we had, as I recall, we had some fairly serious policy questions that we were talking about, particularly in on the conspiracy. And I don't know, frankly, whether it makes any sense to go ahead. I think
we're on different grounds, certainly, with inchoate crimes.
None of this has been looked at by the Senate. None of the last four sections. The first ten have been pretty
well. We looked at them, but I know we're going to have to do some more work on those latter ones, on the venue and and so on.
We distributed that material from Lezak's office on this too, that we haven't had a chance to talk about.
And I don't know.
What's Lezak talking here about Kodiakus versus the United States? I feel the power of his tongue. Remember that? Do you have his copy of his thing? It says, I'm enclosing a memorandum of draft proposal conspiracy for Jack Collins' assistant, with which I am in general agreement. After I looked it over, I assume he means the Collins thing. I went and looked again at the case of Kodiakus versus the United States on a question of charging separate conspiracy. This case holds that it is improper to so charge under federal law. Well, I don't know what he means by that, because as I recall, Kodiakus was a very interestingly different case of the, I've got an example in here, it's the Spokes conspiracy. Spokes of the wheel.
Was that the war, bringing in the war brides case?
No, this is the one where they were defrauding one of the lending agencies of the government to make home improvements and some such. And each one of these people out here on the spokes, these individual people that want to borrow money or get a loan approval or something, would go to this center, the hub here, who was running this racket, and agree with him that he would put in false statements or that they'd do this and that to get it. And then he, in turn, had about 6 or 8 or 100 people on the same deal. And none of these people knew of the existence of anyone else. Kodiakus held that could not be charged as a conspiracy with all the others. Well, I think I agree, clearly. And our draft, I think, agrees with that. That's what threw me off so much about his remark, that he says, this seems, by citing Kodiakus, he seems to be saying that our draft is inaccurate with respect to joining conspiracies. And some kinds of conspiracies, that is the non-spoke hub conspiracies, can be joined under present law in the United States courts. I was really puzzled by that.
Well, I haven't gone back and read that. I don't know. No. Well,
his case is switched.
Well, yeah, it may be too. I don't know.
There's a bunch of those funny conspiracy fact situations you've got to be kind of careful with. They look a lot different when you chart them out. The Kodiakus looks a lot different than the Cheney kind of, where they all link like this in a row. And all probably know about each other.
Well, I don't know. It just seems to me that in this, we've got to have the subcommittee work on it.
Oh, I agree, yeah.
So I don't think we ought to just try to get another subcommittee meeting as soon as we can.
Now, what we can do now with responsibility, as soon as these changes are made, is to bring it up to date with the revised commentary and get it ready to go to the full commission.
It's going to be unnecessarily, unhappily, going to be delayed, as I am booked in our finals and papers, but until the 14th of June. And then that week, we've got a commission meeting, and I've got to go down to the judicial conference for 2 days, so that week is gone. So it's going to be at least 3 weeks before I can do this. Really, I find that difficult, because if we postpone this thing time and again, and I keep getting told, I'll bet you